It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
This is Cultural Baggage with the unvarnished truth about the drug war. I'm Dean Becker.
I want to tell you something. I have been in probably 100, 150 hearings like this at various times in my political career.
Okay, this is Cultural Baggage with the unvarnished truth about the drug war. I'm Dean Becker. Steve Nolan is our engineer, and Tammy and Cheryl and John are here to man the phones and the computers. Our scheduled guest for the evening, Chris Redd, Director of Public Promotions for Narco 9 Arrowhead, will join us in a few moments. But we're lucky that David Robix is deemed to join us for a few moments, and we'll bring him to the mic here in just a couple of minutes. But I want to read a couple of pieces of news for you. Representative Dennis Kucinich of Ohio became the first Democratic presidential candidate to endorse the legalization of medical marijuana when he told the San Francisco Chronicle on Wednesday that it should be available to, quote, any patient who needs it to alleviate pain and suffering, end quote, regardless of the current federal drug laws. He went on further to say that compassion requires that medical marijuana be available, Kucinich said during a telephone interview after a campaign stop in Cupertino. He went on to say, we must have health care systems which are compassionate, so I support it without reservation. Here's a story from a CNN Time News poll that was conducted that shows 80% of Americans believe that medical marijuana should be legally available. Federal prosecutors are now asking for a 5-year prison sentence for Ed Rosenthal, the prominent medical marijuana advocate in San Francisco, who was convicted of growing pot for a San Francisco dispensary. He'll be sentenced this coming Thursday. Out of Ottawa, the Canadian government has proposed a bill that would decriminalize marijuana, but it's already in danger of dying as the order paper faces a potentially lethal mix of internal liberal dissent and parliamentary deadlines. Just one day after the liberals introduced the landmark legislation, the backbenchers said they were opposed to the pot bill and were preparing for its burial. And even those backing the bill were conceding an already heavy parliamentary agenda may make it impossible to pass it into law before the end of the year and a change in the liberal leadership. Meanwhile, pot is still legal in Ontario, Canada, after the laws were declared null and void 2 weeks ago. In a day unmatched in any other court in Ontario, a federal prosecutor has now stayed charges against more than 80 people facing counts of possession of less than 30 grams of pot.
In that regard, here's a report from Canadian broadcast television via Pot TV.
It's decriminalization, not legalization, but it is still controversial. The committee's chair described how the new rules might work.
The committee heard that the prosecution of cannabis-related offenses takes up too much of our scarce criminal justice resources. We want the prosecution of the new regulatory offense to be done through the issuance of tickets. Fines would be paid without a court appearance, and enforcement would not result in a criminal conviction. The committee hopes that these changes will free police and judicial resources to pursue other, more serious criminal activity. We hope that the Government of Canada and all Canadians will see our recommendations as constructive, practical, and compassionate.
Now, I want you to be sure and catch the daily 420 Drug War News Monday through Saturday, somewhere around 420. And you can get more in-depth analysis of the news that's being crafted by this horrible drug prohibition. Now, without any further ado, I'd like to welcome our guest for the evening, David Robix.
Hey, glad to be here.
Thank you, sir. I'm glad you could come down. We're keeping you mighty busy at KPFT,
right? That's a good thing.
It is a good thing. We're glad you're here. You're having an event tomorrow. We'll probably play the promo here in a little bit, but tomorrow afternoon, is it?
Tomorrow evening. It starts at 6 and goes on until around 10, and there's going to be, well, I'll be playing a sort of concert at the end of the, at around 8, and before that there's going to be all kinds of great stuff going on, poetry and music from India, and a performer from India. I'm not sure who that is, but I don't live around here, but yeah, that's happening. There's going to be food and local brewery beer, and it's a benefit concert for KPFT and the Harris County Greens, and come one, come all.
You bet. I first heard your music on Democracy Now! It's been some months back. You came on and you sang a song that you played earlier today, so we won't ask you to do it again, but I really love it. Coke is the drink of the Death Squads, and it's certainly true.
It is.
heard from a reporter out of South America who indicated that each year, though Coca-Cola denies they put any cocaine in their product, that they do actually import tons of coca leaf to a factory in Atlanta, Georgia, for making the secret flavorings, whatever
yeah,
it might be.
You know, I've heard that as well from people in Colombia that they are in fact using coca leaf. I didn't hear about them importing it to Atlanta because the Coca-Cola that's consumed in Colombia, for example, is actually produced in Colombia. So, you know, I don't know about the coca leaf in Atlanta, but I've heard that they do buy large quantities of coca leaf, which of course is legal in Latin America, I think, generally.
The story is available at narconews.com.
Narconews.com.
I didn't look it up, but it's there, folks. Go
it's
check it out.
Great stuff, Narconews.
Yeah, it is. Al's a brave fella. I understand you have a new CD out. Could you tell us what that is?
Well, it's coming up. I'll be recording it at the end of June. I mean, I have a new CD out as of last fall, but there will be another new CD as of next fall, and it'll be recorded at the end of June in Boston.
Well, hopefully you'll play us a song here in a little bit, but let's go ahead and... you have a track queued up for us in there, Steve. What are we going to hear?
This is a track called "Deadhead in Prison," which I wrote after reading. It was a traveling exhibit that was going around to different cafes and museums and stuff about the drug war and the victims of the drug war. And I wrote this about one particular case in Texas that I read about. But it could just as well be about various friends of mine when I was a teenager touring around with the Grateful Dead. You know, every day you kind of look around, see who's there, and, you know, somebody's missing. You say, oh, where's so-and-so? Oh, he got busted, you know, and that was just a perpetual daily affair. These, you know, mostly runaways, you know, 17, 18, 19 years old. Of course, the ones over 18 were the ones in the worst shape, and for when they get busted for selling small amounts of weed or acid or whatever, and, you know, of course, you know, the ones selling acid generally resulted in, you know, got the worst, the most horrific penalties, you know,
right,
because of the way that the drug laws are set up, weighing the paper and all.
Right, if you took the weight of the product, they didn't have a scale fine enough to
measure. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Well, Steve, go ahead and play that track for us.
It was all about living the good things of the earth. It was all about loving this crazy accident of birth. It was all about traveling, hearing those shoe bells ring. It was all about dancing and hearing the fat man sing. And it's like a bad trip in hell, stranded and broke. It's 20 years in this cell. It's like a life up in smoke. With a sweet gypsy tribe. It was all about feeling the pulse of a vibe. And sure, I smoked kind bud, and I did window pane, and I soaked up the beauty of the warm summer rain. It's like a bad trip in hell, stranded and 20 years in this cell. It's like a life up in smoke. Mm-hmm.
And I slept in the shadows of Golden Gate Park. Watched the moon shine, felt the breeze in the dark. The whole world was mine, but I lived for a song. Now I'm stuck in this cell, and all the good days are gone. And it's like a bad trip in hell, stranded and broke, 20 years in this cell. It's like a life up in smoke.
That's nice. Done live. Wait, where was that recorded?
Live at Club Passim in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Oh, it's just beautiful song. I liked it.
Thank you.
Picking. Oh, sweet stuff.
Thanks. And my friend Rich Caligero was joining me on that song on second guitar.
Right. There was a lady who joined you, I guess it was at the Firehouse, with that version I recorded of... Coke is the drink of the Death Squad.
Yeah, Allie Rosenblatt. She recorded the last CD with me, too.
Now
she's a full-time union organizer in Hartford, so she doesn't tour with me anymore.
Yeah, she's got another job to do. We also want you to do a live song for us. And I'll tell you a quick story. April 20th of last year, they had the Normal Conference in San Francisco.
Mm.
And I made a tour through Oakland. And I'm sure maybe it's not on the same caliber, but it was pretty dang cool.
Mm-hmm.
Went to a couple of the cannabis clubs over there.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
Cannabis cafes wide open to the street, looking at a bank across the street.
Yeah.
Wonderful neighborhoods, well-respected, you know. A good facility to take care of the pains of sick and dying people.
Yeah, absolutely. These are great people who are doing this.
And so this next song is Cannabis Cafe?
Yeah, it's more of a sort of frivolous song, but it's, it's certainly related to the drug war. I mean, it's just about what I like to do in my spare time, which I'd be doing more publicly if it were more legal.
You're right. And the thing of it is, no one's died of it yet. I keep wondering why the hysteria. But
it's amazing. It's a complete fabrication, this whole idea that this drug is so dangerous. Meanwhile, you know, the most dangerous drugs are legal.
Yeah. You're killing hundreds of thousands every year.
Yeah, every year. Yeah.
Well, could we hear that song?
Yeah.
Thank you.
I wish I was up in Vancouver at the Cannabis Cafe, smoking good old Centimelia at the beginning of the day. But here I am in New York City, hiding out in Central Park, getting kidnapped by the police today sometime before dark. But I wish I was up in Vancouver at the Cannabis Cafe, smoking good old Centimelia at the beginning of the day. The judge looked down upon me frowning. He said, kid, get on your way. Just don't start out your mornings with espresso in the J. I said, I wish I was up in Vancouver at the Cannabis Cafe, smoking good old Centimelia at the beginning of the day. A ride out to Portland, caught one up to BC, took a bus over to Hastings Street to have a bowl with my coffee. Now up in Vancouver at the Cannabis Cafe, smoking good old Sensimilia at the beginning of the day. Now I'm up in Vancouver at the Cannabis Cafe, smoking good old Sensimilia at the beginning of the day.
Oh, yes, that was wonderful. Yes, yes. When should one get the heck out of Dodge? I don't know. Vancouver's starting to sound pretty nice to me, actually, tell you the truth.
Yeah, it's a great town, but here's where we need to make the changes, most of all.
In the gulag city of the gulag state of this gulag nation, right here in Houston, Texas.
The heart of Mordor, that's right.
When you folks out there stand up and do something, it will change. It just needs a little work. There's a few thousand of us working on it. We could use a few thousand more.
Once enough people stick their necks out, then a mass movement is born, and then you never know where it's going to go from there. And people can think that we're just on the losing end, and we're just we don't have any power. But that can change overnight, really.
Well, and this is true. The fact that the few thousand I'm speaking of, there may be 10, 20, 30,000 people in America working for drug reform, and we've got the other side on the run, and they got millions of people and billions of dollars, and they don't have a leg to stand on. They are on the run.
That's right. When you can speak the truth and it makes sense and people believe it, then it's that can counteract a whole batch of lies. You know, just a little bit of truth can go a long way. But if we have a bigger number of people speaking the truth and getting the word out there, then we can make a huge difference.
Well, David, we're gonna find that promo for your event tomorrow. We'll be playing it here in just a little bit. And I knew the moment I heard you on Democracy Now!, you're my kind of guy. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
All right, I appreciate it. Okay, folks, we're going to take a little break here. We're going to hear from Dan Burton for just a second, and we'll be right back with our scheduled guest for the evening, Chris Redd.
I want to tell you something. I have been in probably 100, 150 hearings like this at various times in my political career. And the story is always the same. This goes all the way back to the 60s, 35, 40 years ago. But there's no end to it. Over 70% of all crime is drug-related, and you've alluded to that today. We saw on television recently Pablo Escobar gunned down, and everybody applauded that and said, that's the end of the Medellin cartel. But it wasn't the end. Yeah, there's still a cartel down there. They're still all over the place. When you kill one, there's 10 or 20 or 50 waiting to take his place. There's always going to be another person in line to make that money. And we go into drug eradication, and we go into rehabilitation, and we go into education, and we do all these things. And the drug problem continues to increase, and it continues to cost us not billions, but trillions of dollars, trillions. And we continue to build more and more prisons, and we put more and more people in jail, and we know that the crimes that they're committing are related most of the time to drugs. So I have one question I'd like to ask all of you, and I think this is a question that needs to be asked. What would happen if there was no profit in drugs?
We're back. I want to go ahead and bring on our next guest for the evening. He is the Director of Promotions for Narco Non Arrowhead, and I want to welcome him to the show. Chris Redd.
Hey, how you doing this evening?
Well, good. Chris, how are you?
Well, I'm doing pretty good.
Well, good. We're glad to have you with us. I want to preface this show by just saying I'm very honored that you deemed to join us. I think it appropriate that, we're not on the opposite sides exactly. We need to find ways of better conducting this drug war, if you will. Ways of helping one another to get through it. Ways of bettering our society. Am I right?
You're absolutely correct. In fact, I was kind of listening in before I came onto the show at what was going on in your guest. And the fact is there are literally millions of Americans out there who are dying on a daily basis from drug addiction, from heroin addiction, cocaine addiction, from these drugs that are wrecking our bodies and wrecking our lives and, quite frankly, wrecking society as a whole. And there is an alternative. I don't believe that the incarceration system is really working out. We've tried that for how many years now, and it hasn't got us anywhere. What it's done is it's increased the problem. But there is an alternative out there.
Well, I would agree. Now, the one thing I would like to interject here is I think the the most horrible drug of them all is the one that's available at the 7-Eleven, and that's alcohol.
And that's one of the kickers of them all, because that is a legal drug, and the fact is everybody knows that it has its dangers, and yet it's one of the most widely used. In fact, let me just give you a real quick statistic.
Okay.
There's actually, between the age group of 12 years old to 21 years old, there's actually 50% of Americans out there using alcohol on a daily basis. Now, this is a drug where individuals, when they drink it, you know, of course, you know, they get inebriated, and a lot of individuals will come home, have a couple of beers after a hard day's work, and that's one thing. But there's individuals out there who take it to an excess. They get behind the wheel of a car, and next thing you know, either a child's getting run down or something to an extreme is happening, or they're destroying their own life.
Right, and, I was an alcoholic for many years. I'm lucky as of May 8th, makes 18 years without a drink. And prior to that, you know, I had car wrecks, fights, you name it, fender benders and just incidents, forgotten how the hell did I get home, that kind of thing. Scary stuff. And, I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's one of the free treatment centers. And I felt good about it. I actually learned a lot. You hear the stories of other people, and it helps you maybe get a better focus on your own life. But then I felt like a hypocrite because I still smoke pot, because to me, it's not so much a crutch, because it is also a pain reliever for some of my, medical ailments, motorcycle wrecks, etc. And, it's better than opiates or, codeine, that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the fact is, a true addiction is actually defined as the inability to complete a cycle of action without a chemical substance. I myself have gone through a drug addiction. I was a heroin addict. I first started using drugs when I was 13 years of age, eventually moved up to cocaine, crack, heroin, the whole nine yards. I've actually been clean and sober for over 2.5 years now. And just to give you an example, whenever I was out there and I was suffering through my addiction, I couldn't even get out of bed in the morning to brush my teeth, take a shower, do all these things that a normal human being would do unless I had that heroin right next to me. And it was a horrible drug and a horrible addiction.
Right. I guess I was blessed that heroin just made me sick, and I didn't like the high. I've always been more of a, I don't know. I'm not going to get into that. But the whole point of it is, I guess, Chris, is you and I had a bit of a discussion earlier this week. I promoted on the 420 News, and I wondered if you've had time to reconsider. I have, and I think I may be willing to readdress my stance a bit. And that is in regards to what would happen were we to legalize drugs, as Dan Burton pointed out on the recording just a moment ago. And even this, congressional statesman, if you will, is considering what we should do and if we shouldn't just go ahead and legalize it.
Well, I think one of the big issues out there about legalizing drugs is the fact that we'd be able to control the distribution of the drugs.
To adults.
To adults. My only slant on that, where you're probably going to kind of disagree with me on that, is the fact that, alcohol is put in the same way. It is a controlled substance, and adults are the only ones who are supposed to be using this drug. Same with nicotine, so on and so forth. Yet we still have a lot of individuals in the younger generation who haven't quite developed that full thought, the full reality on what these drugs, heavy drugs, will do to a person. And they're still using alcohol, and they're still smoking cigarettes, and they're still destroying lives. I don't know how many of hundreds of thousands of individuals in high school die a year from drinking and driving related accidents.
Well, Chris, my take on that is, if it were legal, regulated, distributed to adults, it would take away the black market profits. It would take away the incentive for somebody to hang out on the street corner to instead of making a $20 sale, he can only get about 20 cents, and it's just not going to be worth it anymore.
Well, the fact is, overseas and the Asian, or I'm sorry, in the overseas countries, Iraq and Iran, there's, the Golden Triad, which, it's kind of a double danger there, because in one way they're selling drugs in order to fund these terrorist activities, so they're killing off our society that way. Not only that, that's how they're raising their money in order to do these national horrific events that are occurring in our society today, such as what occurred several years ago, the September 11th event.
Right. Well, but again, if we were to legalize it, we would take away their profits. Immediately, their stash would become worthless.
I can't really argue with that one.
Okay. Well, then let's move on. All right. You know, I think about, you know, treatment. The government is now touting the fact that the predominant number of children, you know, being sent to treatment are being sent there for marijuana. And I, let me just ask you your take. Is that what you're seeing at your facility?
What I actually see at our facility here is more of the hardcore addictions, more of the addictions to the heroin, methamphetamines, which is becoming a really, really big one, crack cocaine, cocaine as well. Now, most of the individuals that I see go through our program smoke marijuana or drink alcohol as well. But what I really see here is the harder addictions, the drugs that really do quickly take it all away from you, so to speak.
Right. I understand. You know, we have spent well in excess of $1 trillion on this. And as you said earlier, the success has just not come forward for all this effort and millions of people arrested and lives ruined, basically. What is the solution? Do you feel that, we're never going to we're never going to control drugs. We're never going to make them disappear. So, isn't the government barking up the wrong tree?
Well, I think really what the key is, you know, we may not be able to make drugs disappear. The fact is, you know, for medical uses, there are needs for opiates and so on and so forth. But the fact also remains that I really think that we can drive away the addiction problem, therefore driving away the problem of crime that goes along with that. Like the statistic earlier on in your show said, 70% of crimes are drug-related. Now, where that's coming from is individuals who are addicted to the drugs, who see no other way except for, okay, I have to find the money to get my next fix for that crack or that heroin or whatever it may be. And so they go out, they commit a crime, and so that they can get high and maintain their addiction and feel normal, so to speak. I really don't think that the whole incarceration system is really working to solve that problem. You know, you have an individual, he gets arrested for, you know, possession or what have you. He goes to jail. He learns how to get away with it kind of next time. It's kind of like, you know, the government's paying to school him. Now, however, if we actually take a look at what really happened and solve the true problem, the addiction itself, what caused this individual to use drugs and alcohol, get rid of the physical aspects of the addiction, and so on and so forth, I think we'd really start to see more of an increase in no more drug addiction in America. Our crime rate will lower in the whole nine yards.
I like what I'm hearing there. Chris, we're going to take a little short break. We're going to come back and take some phone calls. I see we've already got a couple online. Our number here, 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738. Be right back.
I'm Dr. Jane Maxwell. I'm with the University of Texas in Austin. And for more than 30 years, I have been tracking trends in drug use and patterns in drug use in the state of Texas, around the nation, and around the world.
What do you see as the best way to help bring an end to the massive harms of the drug war?
I think the best way to bring an end is first to provide treatment on demand so that every person who is addicted can access treatment immediately, that they don't have to be put on a waiting list. And secondly, as we learn more and more about the brain and how different drugs affect the chemistry on the brain, we're going to see new medications come out to help alleviate the cravings that are being caused by the changes in brain chemistry. And that way, if we can prevent consumption by providing people alternatives to help them get treatment so they don't have to use drugs, that'll be the biggest impact we can make.
Okay, now, given that the treatment industry here in America, you know, is a multi-billion-dollar venture at this time, what can we perceive about the situations where, say, a youth who has been caught while he was just experimenting with marijuana a few times, and he winds up in a residential center where he's exposed to the history, the lifestyle, and the machinations of hard drug users?
One of the things that we're beginning to look at, and we need to look very carefully, is that kids who have been caught smoking marijuana, have gotten in trouble with the law for using marijuana, often do not meet the clinical definition of addiction. They need an intervention. They need to be turned around. They need to be told if this keeps up, they could be in trouble. Their lives are already in trouble because they've been busted. They're probably not doing well in school. But they need a good intervention. They need some guidance, some counseling, and get them back on the right track. Those people who are using heavily need access to good treatment. So we need to differentiate between young kids who need to be intervened with and turned around, and then to provide good, solid treatment for people who do need it.
Okay, that was Jane Maxwell, and she's currently working at the UT, but she was formerly with the Texas Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse. And, Chris, she's pretty much agreeing with where we're headed here, I think.
Yeah, and actually I was kind of interested when she was talking about the physical cravings that these addictions cause, and more studies about it, and it's actually been found in one of the technologies we use here, is the fact that whenever we use drugs and alcohol, what actually occurs is these little drug residues get stored into our fat tissue, right? And what happens is, let's say we have an individual who's been clean and sober for a year and a half, and he's outside, he's playing basketball, or maybe he's having sex with his wife, or maybe even getting into an argument. Anything that causes our heart rate to increase causes our body to naturally break down our fat tissue in order to give itself energy, correct?
Right.
Right. So what actually happens is that fat tissue gets broken down, and that drug residue is re-released back into our system, goes into our bloodstream, eventually finds its way to the brain. The brain says, oh, wait a second, I recognize this, I like this, sends a message to the body, give me more, and it's what's called a physical craving, and it's actually the number one reason for a relapse in America today. And there is actually a drug-free way to eliminate those drug residues out of your system. It's called the New Life Detoxification Program, which we use here at Narcanon on a daily basis.
All right. Now, I want to hear more about that, but we do have some callers. I think we ought to get to a couple of them. We have Donald out of Brooklyn, New York. Good evening, Donald.
Hey, Dean, how's it going?
Well, it's going real good. How are you?
I'm doing good.
Did you have a question for Mr. Red?
Yes, I had a question for Chris. I was listening to the program, and I took exception to the, or one of the things I have an issue with is the idea, we hear this so often, that the criticism of legalizing drugs is that we have legal drugs right now, alcohol and tobacco, and somehow kids are able to, you know, are able to get a hold of these drugs. And the logic seems to be because they're able to get a hold of alcohol and tobacco, two drugs that, I mean, not only legal, but, I mean, they've been accepted in our culture for a very long time, that they will then be able to get a hold of these other legal drugs. And I have a lot of different issues on that, and I'm sure I'm not going to be able to get to all of them. But I guess the biggest issue I have is that alcohol and tobacco, and I guess I wonder if Chris would agree with this, alcohol and tobacco, you know, they're the most addictive and they're the deadliest drugs. And could the person take the point of view that by legalizing all these other drugs, which are actually less addictive and less deadly, or at least this is according to the National Institute of Drug Abuse, this is the government, you know, study group or whatever you want to call them. These are the scientists. These are the scientists that the government employs. They say alcohol and tobacco are the deadliest, or they say actually that they're the most addictive. It's the morgues and the morticians who say they're the deadliest. Wouldn't it actually keep kids away from alcohol and tobacco by legalizing these other drugs, because then the communities and, you know, the neighborhoods would actually start to take seriously the idea that we should actually do more to keep kids away from drugs, that we should actually really enforce the rules, the laws against IDing. To force people to show their ID, to actually follow through on these laws, which we haven't done for alcohol and tobacco. I mean, come on, tobacco, the deadliest, almost like 500,000 every year, and what was it, just like a few years ago only was when we stopped with the vending machines. For the longest time, the deadliest drug in America, being in the world, being sold, tobacco. We just put these machines out there in the neighborhood. When I was a kid, I used to be able to go into the supermarket and buy cigarettes from these vending machines with no difficulty at all. Nobody ID'd me. There was nobody there. It was just a machine.
Well, Donald, let's let Chris go ahead and address that.
Right. Well, Donald, I definitely see where you're coming from with your question there. And to an extent, I can almost agree with you. The fact that nicotine and alcohol are sold so readily and they're on our streets so readily. And like you said, the vending machines just up, 5 years ago, I think, is when they finally got them off. But the fact is that these harder drugs, such as heroin, cocaine, methamphetamines, the whole nine yards, I know you're from the Brooklyn area, I believe, on a daily basis, 30 individuals a day, okay, and there's 365 of these in a year, so I can't even do the math that quick in my head, but I guess that's like 9,000, 10,000 individuals a day are dying from heroin overdoses alone in the Brooklyn area, in New York. And on the weekends, it said that that number is actually doubled. So the fact is I can see the control aspect that you're talking about, but the fact is that these drugs are just as dangerous as alcohol and tobacco.
Wait, Chris, state that number again. How many dying?
30 individuals a day in the New York area, in the Brooklyn area, die from a heroin overdose. 30 a day. On the weekends, that number is doubled. And this is talking from an actual mortician who works in the area.
Well, no, I'd like to see the stats on that. My numbers show, that's just way off.
Well, I mean, am I still on?
Yes, hey, Don.
Okay, well, all right, hey, okay, let me, can I just address that for a moment? These people, they're not dying from heroin. I mean, what they're dying is they're dying from some junk that they're getting on the streets of somebody's calling heroines, but they got a bunch of other crap in there that is genuinely toxic. They don't know what the dosage is. So, I mean, yeah, they're overdosing because they don't know what the dose is. This is how you overdose. When you don't know what the dosage and then you guess, that's how you overdose. And that's the situation that we have right now. So these people who are dying in Brooklyn, I'm not in the position to dispute the statistic, but I'm in the position to say, hey, these people aren't dying from the heroin, they're dying from prohibition. They're dying. This is exactly the same thing that happened during the prohibition of alcohol. People were drinking alcohol during prohibition of alcohol, and they were dying from it. And the reason they were dying from it was because they had a lot of junk in there. It was the government mandate. In fact, the government mandated this, that they put the methanol in the stuff that people were drinking so that people would die from it as a way of deterring people from drinking. So the heroin, they're not dying from heroin. I think I made my point.
Yeah, I think so. Do you want to address that, Chris?
Well, the thing is I don't know if I have the reality. I've been there. I've used heroin. I've used crack cocaine. I personally know the damage that it did to my system. I literally watched myself wither away because of the fact that I was using this hardcore drug. Whenever I was using heroin, I wasn't eating. Was it the fact that I just didn't want to eat, or was it actually the fact that the drug was deterring my appetite?
Well, I guess my response to that, if I can still respond, you said before that you started at 13, right?
I started using marijuana and alcohol at 13. I started using heroin at the age of 18.
At the age of 18. So, yeah. I mean, I think it's reasonable to say that if perhaps we had more control over what kids get to ingest. In other words, I mean, the thing that I always like to say is that if drugs were legalized, well, who would you rather see selling drugs? I mean, people who are, law-abiding citizens who wouldn't sell to kids, or people who are criminals on the street corner who would.
Donald, we're going to have to cut it off. I got a lot of folks stacked online here. We appreciate your call.
Outstanding. It's a great show, Gene.
Good to hear from you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, let's go to Dan on line three. Hello, Dan.
Yeah, I'm a retired physician. I cannot agree with your guest on several points. First of all, addiction is not the cause of crime. The proximate cause of crime, the underlying proximate cause, is the prohibition, the criminalization, and the resultant black market. As your previous guest pointed out, the mortality and morbidity from alcohol and tobacco vastly exceeds the mortality and morbidity from quote-unquote illegal drugs. And even, I really doubt the statistics of that your guest cited regarding deaths from heroin overdoses in Brooklyn. That's just very much counter to the statistics that I've seen. But in any case, I think that legalization and regulation is the answer. Tobacco was not effectively regulated even a few years ago. It's gotten much better, and I think it's a good example. It's a much more dangerous drug. It's a vastly more dangerous drug than marijuana. But it's a good example of what you can do with a very, very, very dangerous drug. You can card kids and not really restrict that drug, despite the corporate pressure to sell it to the kids. And as your previous call pointed out, the answer is to get a clean, regulated drugs out there for the people who will use them no matter what you do. And then when they do and they get into trouble, you pull the fat out of the fire. And one more quick comment about another thing your guest said. My undergraduate degree is in biochemistry. You do not break down fat for energy. And this idea that in a time of stress, that fat would be broken down and tiny amounts of residual drug released is just it's really ludicrous. Glucose is the energy molecule. You do not make glucose from fat. So you really need to check your facts there, because that's just a fantasy.
Chris, you want to respond?
Yeah, I actually have been through the New Life Detoxification Program. Let me just point out, I absolutely agree that, the whole idea between the alcohol and the tobacco being extremely dangerous drugs that are legal, I completely agree with the fact that they need to be more regularly mandated in the cell to individuals as well. Now, as far as the fact of the drug residues being stored in your fat tissue in the whole nine yards, I've actually gone through the process when I was using drugs and alcohol, and even during the times when I would go through a dry period, so to speak, I'd be outside and I'd be exercising and I'd be doing whatever, and I would actually get these cravings for these drugs. And this is something, I'm not just coming out with out of my hat. This is something I've experienced.
Yeah.
And through
I don't doubt your personal experience. What I'm saying is your explanation for it doesn't hold any water.
Through the fact that I went through this program, I went through the sauna, and I actually got these residues out of my system, I have not since then experienced any of those cravings whatsoever. All the data that I have relates to the fact that whenever you use these drugs and alcohol, they do actually get stored into your fat tissue. And whenever your body breaks down that fat tissue for whatever reason, it gets re-released back into your system.
Well, Chris, is this more just a personal observation than a scientific study?
No, this has actually been studied. In fact, it's still being studied.
What are the references and where are the papers? Because I'm pretty up on this literature. I've never seen anything like that. Plus, it just flies totally in the face of all the pharmacology that I've ever had. And there may be for example, THC does get stored in fat, and that's why you can have small levels for weeks after use and still be detected in urine, but the amounts are tiny, and what's more, stress does not break down fat in, for energy. And so, you know, your personal observations about how you lost your cravings, I don't doubt that, but your theory doesn't hold any water.
Dan, I hate to interrupt, but we do have some other callers been waiting a long time. We will give Chris a chance to address that, but I do want to get the other callers. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I apologize. Thank you, Dan. Okay, the one who's been holding the longest here, Steve from Florida. Hello, Steve.
Hey, Dean, how you doing? I'm calling from Clearwater, Florida.
Yes, it's good to hear from you.
Good. I appreciate all that you guys do to put the show together. I appreciate Chris coming on the show tonight because it allows us to keep going. I just had some comments, and I've enjoyed listening to the show on hold since the start of it here. A couple comments, and then I had a couple questions for Chris.
All right.
First off is that, as we've already mentioned, people don't commit crime for drugs. They commit crime for the money for drugs. For instance, and that's why I noticed in my own life is that I've off and on used marijuana for 27 years, but I've never committed a crime to finance it because for $10 or $20, I can get a sufficient supply of marijuana to last me for a pretty extended period. However, during a three-year period of my life in the early 90s, when I was using cocaine and amphetamines and things that led to compulsive use, I found that I was needing hundreds of dollars to finance them under a criminal market. And as such, I was tempted to commit crimes and fraud and things to get it. Chris, regarding the heroin statistics, anybody that wants to know how many people died of heroin last year can go to drugwarfacts.org. And there's a very good breakdown there of deaths by drugs, both legal and illegal. And perhaps, anyone that's listening could do that and get a good indicator on that. I'm wondering if how many of your clients, how open you are with your clients about the Church of Scientology.
Now, the Church of Scientology, we do not deliver Scientology here. We do not deliver Dianetics here. The program was actually developed by a man by the name of William Benitez, who actually first got the inclination to start the program. He was actually a heroin addict himself. While he was in Arizona State Penitentiary, he read a book called Fundamentals of Thought, which was written by author L. Ron Hubbard, who most individuals know was the founder of the Church of Scientology.
Right.
And he developed, Mr. Benitez developed the Narcanon program himself.
We
do not deliver Dianetics here. We do not use Scientology here, and we do not.
So the detoxification program that you use, the sauna and stuff, has nothing to do with the purification rundown that's used by Scientology?
Now, the purification rundown and the book, Clear Body, Clear Mind, was developed by L. Ron Hubbard.
I see. Okay.
And we do use the purification system here. But the actual tools that we're teaching our
students. So you're suggesting that somebody goes through a sauna and raises their body temperature to some degree, that they sweat out these toxins, but I work in the drug testing industry and with recovering addicts, and when you tell me that these drugs, minute particles of these drugs are in your fat tissue months and years later, it's apparently, if that's so, they're undetectable by any drug test that's given at the federal level or by private employers. Nobody detects, they're not detectable that way. Most of these drugs, cocaine, methamphetamine, they're water soluble. They're going to wash out of your system generally within 48 hours to maybe a couple of weeks if you're a chronic user. That's just, it's just very puzzling to me.
I understand your point because of the fact that it's not detectable in the urine or in the bloodstream.
So it's just this little minute mystery.
These little minute particles in your system.
Correct? Right.
But
which no other healthcare professionals or drug testing folks are seem to be aware of, other than Narcanon.
That's not entirely true. In fact, the PURIF program, as you put it, is actually being used in many different areas across the world for not only the drug problem out there, but also for different problems. For example, the 9/11 event, there's a thing going on with the firefighters that were exposed to the pollution and the chemicals of the buildings collapsing, where
right.
They're actually going through the PURIF program, and actually those individuals were extremely sick, and since the PURIF program, they've made a huge tremendous recovery because of the fact that they're getting these chemicals
okay.
out of their system.
I'm curious, though, when you mentioned that you don't do any proselyting or recruiting for Scientology.
Absolutely not.
Interesting. Clark Carr, one of your national directors, in an article here in the St. Pete Times 2 months ago, said that, quote, 10 to 15% of our graduates become Scientologists. How likely is that, considering demographically that you guys are not a large percentage of the population in relation to other religions? How would one out of six people become a Scientologist coming out of that program if there was not some, you know, let me make clear, I have no particular beef against Scientology mm-hmm. or the fact that you might proselyte it or promote that lifestyle. It apparently works for many people. And if it was part of your program, I can't imagine why that would be a particular crime, other than if you're not disclosing it to people. And they're paying money for what they believe is professional medical treatment, when in reality it's more of a religious philosophy that's being delivered.
I know Clark personally, and I don't know whether or not he made that statement. But
he made
the
statement in the St. Petersburg Times.
Mm-hmm. I do know here that there is no push.
March 30th, 2003. It was a big article, because down here, Cheryl Alderman, who's the director of the center, the Dear Narcanon Center here in Clearwater, was, I don't know that you do this, but she's actively seeking federal tax dollars and federal grants to underwrite the Narcanon program down here, which seems not a good idea constitutionally if you're promoting a religious philosophy. Again, which a philosophy which I don't have particular gripe about, because I, you know, it's no more wacky than any other religious philosophy to me, okay? But getting taxpayer dollars is what led to this story, and this is where Mr. Carr's comment was.
Mm-hmm. I have personally never seen here an individual pushing a student or somebody who's training
for the program. Pushing. No, that suggests boiler room sales tactics. That's not what I'm saying. But, I mean, if it's an active part of the program to say, okay, well, you've been in here for a while, you're working through these steps that we promote, and you're seeing some recovery, well, here's something else that you'll find useful. We're going to mm-hmm. this particular religious philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Steve, I'm going to have to interrupt. I got one other caller, and
thanks for the chance to participate.
I hear you. Let's go ahead.
Have Cheryl leave me on hold, if you would, so I could hear the end of the show.
Well, fair enough. Let's go ahead and go to line 4. We have out of Kentucky, who is it? It's David Duncan. Hello, David.
Hello.
Good evening, sir.
Good evening.
Yes, did you have a question or a statement for Mr. Red?
A comment. I'd have to say amen to just about everything your previous callers have said. It is true that some drugs are stored in fat in the body. Marijuana, for instance, is one that leaves residues in the fat. It's also true that that's absolutely not possible with residues from heroin or cocaine. They're all water-soluble and can be stored in fat. But also, the residues don't produce the drug effect. It's like saying that because you got you burn a piece of paper, you can read the ashes. They're what's left after the drug has been destroyed. So that there is, except for THC, which I say really does deposit in the fats and is still active, you don't have the possibility of this even happening, along with the fact, as your previous caller said, that fat is not broken down under stress to produce energy. That's physiologically false. That whole theory doesn't hold any solid basis.
But Dave, tell them who you are, where you get your understanding of this.
Yes, I've been in the addictions treatment field for 35 years. I'm an active researcher. 5 books, 150 published papers in scientific journals. I'm clinical associate professor of medicine at Brown University. I'm also involved as an adjunct faculty member at several other universities, and I run a consulting firm in the field of drug abuse. I was formerly with the Office of National Drug Control Policy as a contract employee in the Clinton administration. So I have quite a bit of experience in this and a good knowledge of human physiology. And just that theory doesn't hold any water. It is from beginning to end false. Saunas do, because like jogging and many other things, produce endorphins, make you feel better, and that may in fact help in rehabilitation. But that's essentially doing more or less what they're saying the fat breakdown does. The endorphins produce effects like narcotics, and anytime you have somebody in a sauna, you're going to produce narcotic type effects. And if that causes relapse, then saunas ought to cause relapse, not recovery.
Well, that's kind of like I heard from Bill Bennett, the church bingo was the gateway to gambling in Las Vegas, you know?
Yes, well, there are a lot of gateways to just about anything one wants to do.
Yes. David, you know, I appreciate you calling in. It's good to have some of the former guests on the show come in and lend their support or, you know, their outlook at the situation. We're just about out of time. Chris, is there a website you could send folks to if they wanted to learn more about Narconine?
Absolutely. It's www.stopaddiction.com.
All right. You know, I want to thank you for coming on. David, I again want to thank you and all the callers that, you know, joined us this evening. I would invite everybody, if they get the chance, to visit my website, which is cultural-baggage.com. And there, you know, you can hear any of the shows we've done over the last 15 months involving David Duncan. And tomorrow, Chris Red's show will be up. You know, we've had Judge Gray. We've had numerous people who've kicked this drug war around pretty good, and it deserves a good kicking. I want to tell you that. Chris, David, Steve, everybody who called in, thank you so much. We're going to run a couple of little spots here, and we'll wrap it up here in just a minute.
Thank you, Dick.
Thank you.
It's so important for Americans to know that the traffic in drugs finances the work of terror, sustaining terror. The terrorists use drug profits to fund themselves to commit acts of murder. If you quit drugs, you join the fight against terror in America.
Let's see. Arrest millions and millions of American citizens, spend trillions trying to stop a war we can never win, or regulate drugs to adults and immediately destroy the drug lord's stash, bankrupt the terrorists, and practically eliminate drug overdose deaths.
For their work as a grand deceptor, hypocrite, lying weasel, bigot, corporate whore, baby raper, superstitious shill, or ultra sinner, Cultural Baggage is proud to present The Coward of the Week.
Well, this week's Coward of the Week is the Commander-in-Chief, George W. Bush, who, while running for president, said that his compassion for the sick and dying meant that medical marijuana should be a states' rights issue. Now, 2+ years into office, his machinations, his selection of John Ashcroft as the chief moolah and Bill Bennett's protege, John Walters, as head witch doctor, shows Bush to be a liar, a hateful and ignorant servant of the pharmaceutical houses, the energy companies, alcohol and tobacco conglomerates, and the millions of lying weasel cops, judges, and various cretins that love the drug war like it was their mother's milk. So this one's for you, G.W. Bush, Coward of the Week.
Fool me once, shame on you. It fooled me. We can't get fooled again.
Okay, there's our fool and our coward for the week. I want to thank Chris Redd from Narconon, all the guests who called in, and I want to thank David Robix for his fine music. To hear any of our shows, please visit our website, www.cultural-baggage.com.
For my producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, The Unvarnished Truth.